You may remember that in one of the letters from the Masters of the Wisdom to Laura Holloway, this question of birthdays is mentioned. This has nothing to do with the subject. But apparently Mrs. Holloway was disappointed because people didn't remember her birthday. And then the Master wrote and said, what is a birthday? It's just one step nearer to the grave. Unless during the year you have worked or lived a life which has brought you nearer to wisdom, then the birthday doesn't have much significance. So the question is, from birthday to birthday, what are we doing? It's a very interesting letter. Now, going to the subject, I would like to start with a quotation from HBB, who speaks about the doctrines of theosophy and said, these doctrines, if seriously studied, call forth, by stimulating one's reasoning powers and awakening the inner in the animal man, every hitherto dormant power for good in us, and also the perception of the true and the real, as opposed to the false and the unreal. Theosophy's doctrines, if seriously studied, should stimulate the reasoning powers and awaken the inner in the animal man. And this is a very instructive statement. We can ask, first of all, the question, what is theosophy? There are many possible answers. One, people who have been in the Theosophical Society and attended many conventions and so on may give quick answers. Theosophy is the art of life. Theosophy is the teaching of HBB. Theosophy is the ancient wisdom. Theosophy is a Greek word which means divine wisdom. And so on and so forth. But are they really answers? Suppose you say, theosophy is the art of life. It's a good answer up to a point. It's also true enough up to a point if you say it's HBB's teaching or it is the ancient wisdom contained in many religions. All that is true up to a point. But then it only provokes another question. What is the art of life? How do you learn it, practice it? In what does it consist? What did HBB really teach? If we take even this one sentence which I read, have we any comprehension of the doctrines of theosophy after studying it? Because if we have that comprehension, according to her, our reasoning power should be greater. Our insight, intuition should have been awakened to such an extent that the dormant power for good within us must be alive And our perception must be clear so that we know what is real and what is not real. Obviously, in that sense, we have not understood her teaching or learnt what the doctrines are about. So, what is theosophy? What is truth? An age-old question. Unfortunately for humankind, most people are either not interested in the question at all, or they believe they know the answer. Both positions lead to the tragic condition in which we find ourselves, that is, humanity finds itself. As one of the Mahatmas said, I believe it was quoted the other day, I think by Bill, 2/3 of the evil in the world has come from the religious fanatics, those who believe that they know the truth, and what they know is the truth. Many wars, superstitions, cruelties have arisen from this belief in one's own knowledge. There are the others who are just not interested in the question, who are feverishly lost in the pursuit of money, pleasure, and the positions and the opportunities to obtain these. Krishnamurti sometimes made startling statements. And after making that, when there was a discussion, he would say, why don't you challenge me? Why do you accept things so easily? And in fact, that is a question we have to ask ourselves. If we are seriously studying theosophy, why don't we challenge the various doctrines, truths, statements which we encounter? The word challenge doesn't mean reject. This is also very important. It is neither acceptance, acceptance being the lazy way. It's easy to say, so-and-so is my teacher, this is my scripture, the truth is there, and I agree. It's the easiest thing to agree. And the most disrespectful thing that we can do to a teacher, I think, not to examine what he says, he or she says, simply say, I agree. Nor should we reject. Rejection out of hand, without inquiry, is perhaps as unwise as acceptance is. How do we reject? On what basis? If the question, what is theosophy or what is truth, is asked, as we mentioned, there are the people who are not interested, or those who say, I know what the answer is, and also those who say, I don't want to hear all the answers other people have given. I know what it's about. I have my own opinion of what is theosophy or what is truth. And that's as good as anybody else's. But we don't know the answers to the great questions of life. And to believe that we know the answer, perhaps is very great unwisdom. I was going to say foolish, but I don't want to hurt anybody's feeling. We tend to think we know the answers. You know, this is also, by the way, there are people who join the Theosophical Society, and very soon afterwards, they want to say what the Theosophical Society should be doing, that its objects should be changed, that its methods need to be modernized according to their concepts, etc., etc. Or what theosophy is. It is like a person who joins a historical society and says, I think this society ought to be teaching swimming. Well, if you are interested in that, join a swimming club, not the historical society. So, joining the Theosophical Society should have as its purpose trying to understand what is theosophy and what is the work of the Theosophical Society, not in order to tell all the others who are already in it what they should be doing or how they should interpret the word theosophy. This comes out of some kind of self-opinionatedness, which is all rather immature. So, there are these questions of great importance, which Krishnamurti called the impossible questions. The impossible question is one which is impossible because it won't go away. It shouldn't, if we are really seriously interested in it. It is posing itself before the consciousness from time to time, continuously, maybe throughout one's life. The question, what is truth? And let us remember that the motto of the Theosophical Society is, there is no religion higher than truth. The question, what is truth, is a question which should stay before us for perhaps the whole of this life, maybe for many lives to come. It shouldn't disappear. It may not be there all the time, so insistent that we get weary. But rather like the Cheshire cat, perhaps it appears every now and again in unexpected ways. And yet, one cannot answer it simply and quickly, because if we are seriously examining the question, trying to find the answer, every time it seems as if one is near the answer, you will find that there are greater depths. There are subtleties which haven't been perceived earlier. And therefore, the question recedes but does not disappear. And it still remains there, asking you to inquire. Both acceptance and rejection of a question, or if it is not acceptance, the ignoring of a question and rejection, imply that there is no inquiry. There is a kind of obtuseness in the mind, or feeling I know. In the Bhagavad Gita, one of the questions asked of Krishna is answered by his saying, you must find out through inquiry, respectfully inquiring, and then through practice, experimentation, actually trying to see in your life whether the answer is valid or not. And this experimentation is not something that is to be done just once. When a scientist formulates a theory which has to be experimentally proved, I believe it's not enough to make the experiment once, because there may be an error. The experiment must be repeated. But every time the experiment is repeated, whoever performs the experiment must keep his mind open and not believe that the answer has already been obtained. If the answer has been got, then there is no point in doing the experiment again. The mind must be open to whatever the new experiment will show. So, in our lives, what we understand of the doctrine has to be tested, but not tested with preconceptions. And this is no easy matter. At no time can we afford to say that I've already caught this, I know what it is, let me get on. Unless the mind is completely open, that means it is willing to put aside all it has accumulated or come to. Every time it is confronted with something else in life, it may be a new idea somebody puts forth, or an idea which is put in a different kind of language, as was mentioned yesterday by Joy, or a new fact. The mind must be open to examine it. Examine it, but also relate it to what the wise have said. There are schools of philosophy where they have discussed at great length what are the means to real knowledge. And in the East, at least, they tend to say that if you think of only one means, it's easy to be led astray. There is, for example, truth or insight, may not be truth, but just a flash of insight, which comes down to the physical level as an inspiration, intuition, which was the subject dealt with in the workshop. But is there some certainty that it is really intuition? If you are writing poetry or singing a song, of course it doesn't matter. But in other contexts, it's rather dangerous to believe that something which comes into my head is intuition. It may not be. It may be something which I have longed for, part of my desire system, which has lain in the subconscious and expresses itself as an inspiration coming directly from the masters or something like that. You will find very often this egotistical element when people bring down messages from above. If there is nothing in the message itself, it's a great kick to the ego to believe that the message has to come through me. So it may be only the desire for importance, it may not be intuition. And that is perhaps why HPB says that the serious study of theosophical doctrine stimulates the reasoning powers and also awakens the inner man. The reasoning power has its own value. And that is what they say in various schools of philosophy, that if you go by just what you think you see and your intuition and so on, you may be deceived. Unless it's also substantiated by a well-developed power of reason. All truth is, all truth transcends reason, but it cannot violate reason. It cannot be irrational, unreasonable, illogical, incoherent. So, the reasoning faculty must balance the sensitivity and the openness which allows the higher nature to send a message. And further corroboration can be had from the words of those who have preceded us on the path to wisdom. It may be HPB or anyone else, but we must pay heed to what they say, not say, I don't need all that, I have my own opinions, and I can tell you what truth is. It's not so easy. The difficult questions of life are not instantaneously solved like that. If we believe they are solved, we are merely using words. All questions can be solved at the verbal level. What is the cause of sorrow? It is selfishness. Finished. But do we really deal with the problem of sorrow, which is a vast, pervasive, almost seemingly endless problem? It cannot be dismissed like that. What is the way out of sorrow? We know what the Buddha said, what Jesus taught, what so many people said, but it is a question which each one has to face, and as we said, the question has to remain with one for long periods. One has to apply all one's faculties, study the doctrines, allow one's reasoning to develop, give room to the intuition to speak, and then perhaps if all these show the way and they concur in what they have to say, then we are nearer to understanding. Now, what is truth? Let us come back to that question, which is very nearly the same thing as saying, what is theosophy? Truth cannot be what we think, any of us. We've already mentioned the fact that there are so many people who believe they know the truth. The Muslims, the Christians, the Hindus, they've all got the truth. And every individual there may believe that he knows the truth better, and this is how sects develop within these religions. And there are new sects forming. So there is the danger that theosophy also could become a sect like this, if little groups of people say, we have got the answer, and our answer is the correct answer. This is one of the important reasons why the question, what is theosophy, must remain as a question, and not to be answered by anybody. Each one has to inquire into the answer. And that inquiry is rather arduous. The key to theosophy, dealing with the future of the Theosophical Society, mentions, that is, HPB mentions, that when sectarianism, which means dogmatism, enters into the Theosophical Society, the society becomes a kind of a sect. It will become a corpse. The body of the society may survive, but not its soul. And therefore, what we are called upon to do is to carry on this inquiry and instill into others, communicate to others is a better way of putting it, communicate to others the extraordinary value of the inquiry into the question, what is theosophy or what is truth? Sometimes, if we use the word theosophy, it puts off people because they believe it is a sect. So, depending on the context, as mentioned yesterday, one may use different words. Why is humanity in such a predicament? Why do we lack the wisdom to create a beautiful world? What is wisdom? You may put the question in different ways. But we must share with others the feeling we have for the importance of that question, because on it depends the future, not only of the Theosophical Society for the next 100 years, because the Theosophical Society only exists for the sake of humanity and all other living creatures. So, for the sake of life on this planet as a whole, there must be inquiry into this question. What is truth? Let us keep to that for the time being. Is it only just gathering facts about various things? There are innumerable facts in life. And perhaps there will be no success in gathering or gaining all the possible facts about everything in the universe. Whatever means we may invent supercomputers of all kinds, we may still never arrive at the end. Because the universe is so vast, so complex, so many layers within layers, levels of existence. And I believe that the investigators are now aware of this, that what they have learnt up to now is no more than the crust, perhaps not even the crust. In the Bhagavad Gita again, Krishna, as who represents the universal life, the supreme life, says there is no end to the glories, the details about my manifestations. Is there not something in the Bible which is very similar? You will find it in almost all the scriptures. I can't remember the sentence, but somewhere in the Bible it is said that the glories of God are limitless. So, truth is not a question of obtaining endless information about the nature of objects, about the world which can be grasped by our senses, by our minds, because both our brains as well as our senses have very serious limitations. Their range is extremely limited. The mind as we use it, the ordinary mind, has a well-established pattern of operation. When it sees something, it grasps a few features enough to distinguish the object it sees from other objects. So, when you look at a tree, you immediately say, this is a pine tree. All the sequential reasoning is unnecessary. The mind is so quick, it grasps the essential features and it says it is not the same as the banana tree because the features there are different. These features may be the color, the texture, the shape, and so on. So it has to do that. If it didn't do that, we couldn't function in our daily lives. If you cannot distinguish the street where you live from other streets and your house door from other house doors, it would be disaster. If we couldn't recognize the people around us, well, we couldn't function. Therefore, the mind is made that way, the brain mind. And it associates certain of these objects with pleasure and others with non-pleasure, not necessarily pain. And it stimulates desire. So that is a further complication because its mode of operation makes it see what it wants to see according to its desires. Everything is colored. Many of you know the word vairagya. The second of the qualifications given at the feet of the master, it is derived from raga, which means both desire and color. All desire, passion, wanting, colors the mind. So with this kind of mind, which is easily colored by its desires into forms of prejudice, presuppositions, conceits of various kinds, with this mind and the senses, which may be more or less efficient, we think we know the whole of the world. And therefore this feeling arises, I know. There are so many matters on which subconsciously we go around with this idea, background, I know. And therefore, to be free of that, to look into inquiry means to look into a question with no preconception, nothing that is wanted out of it is very important. That is, you know the golden stairs leading to the temple of wisdom, a clean life, an open mind, a pure heart. Why a clean life? Because the sensitivity of our perceptions are eroded by a life which is not of the right kind. If we are, for example, living with a certain amount of crude enjoyment, wrong type of food, with too much excitement and so on, our powers of perception will be affected. But I won't go into that. So we look at the world with instruments which are very inadequate and come to the conclusion, I know. But even if we were capable of knowing all the facts in the universe, we would still not know what is truth, because truth is different from fact. If we cannot receive something which is beyond the senses, beyond this mind, which is always finding differences, differentiating between things, docketing them in various compartments, comparing, and so on. It is beyond all that. And I think we have all had experience, enough experience, to realize that truth is not just in the appearance of things, in the features, in the facts. As one of the Mahatmas said, there is a latent meaning and a hidden purpose in everything, in every individual existence, however unimportant it may seem to us. In the little caterpillar crawling up and down, in the snake we may disapprove of, in everything, in the thorny bush, there is a latent purpose, latent meaning and hidden purpose. And to become aware of that, one must not go with ready-made ideas. And that is why HPB says that our studies must awaken the inner man, the inner faculties, the faculties of subtle perception, which is not psychic power. In fact, psychic power can be very misleading. It's an illusion. It also deals with forms. And through development of psychic powers, clairvoyance or what not, one only enlarges the field at the same level, the field of perception at the same level, and doesn't go deeper to become aware of the purpose. When there is some kind of a shadowy love between human beings, what we normally call love, what happens? It means that there is some deep awareness, deeper awareness of a value, a purpose in that which is loved. Mother's love has been lauded. For the child may be difficult, may become deformed, may rebel against her, but her love remains steady at its best because she sees something within that child or person which others don't see. She may not be aware of it, but we call it love. Love is not love that alteration finds, is that not so? Because the alteration comes through getting attached to something changeable. But there is the unchangeable, the true value, purpose and meaning everywhere. And once one gets some even unconscious glimpse of it, then the love becomes more real. So truth is not just in the outward appearance of things. It is not contextual, dependent on time or place, on the form something takes, or the name that is given to it. It's a great fact that a rose is a rose, whatever name you give to it. The form may change. A young woman becomes a wrinkled old person. But where to a person, to another who has seen the truth, it doesn't matter. To this extent, we all know it, that the context doesn't have any relevance to knowing the truth. To know the truth is to know a thing as it is, deep within, not just outside. The subtle, the immortal aspect as much as the appearance. Now, the danger when we don't make inquiry, seriously, sustained inquiry, keeping the question alive before ourselves, is that we easily fall into the error of believing that a relative truth, some fact at the superficial level, the reality of appearance, because the appearance is real. We can't deny that. It's a fact. You have white skin, I have brown skin, that's a fact. These differences do exist. We take all this to be truth. We give it an importance which it does not have. And even after inquiry, as we said, some kind of a meaning comes to the mind, and that appears like truth. But there may be subtler meanings, deeper levels, which we have to examine. That is why in that beautiful Life of the Buddha by Edwin Arnold, Light of Asia, it is said, veil after veil will lift. It's not only at the later stages of spiritual development, but if we keep our minds open in a state of respectful inquiry, then all the time there is movement. There are further things to discover. There are new areas, subtle areas of meaning and value. And if we don't keep the mind open, then we miss the meaning. Because the subtlety of truth, the depths cannot be put into words. We have words only for the things that we perceive with our senses and mind. So there are no words to describe certain things. The Mahatmas wrote, most if not all of our secrets are incommunicable. Not because we want to withhold them, but because the receptivity is not equal to our desire to communicate. And when they do communicate the incommunicable, sometimes it is in the form of paradox, of symbol, of parable, of imagery, suggestions, hints, and when the mind is not accustomed to listening, to being open, to inquiring, not rejecting or accepting, it misses the meaning. Sometimes the meaning may come home to an inquiring mind much later, not at the time that the words are spoken or the truth is before one's eyes. So the open mind, the inquiring mind, must respond to the hidden, the subtle, the unusual. And it cannot do that unless it approaches everything respectfully. In modern civilization, especially in the West, this word respect doesn't carry much weight, I know. But unless we have respect for every form of life, including the wise ones who may have knowledge which we do not possess, knowledge or wisdom rather, then we will not be able to really understand. In Light on the Path, there is the statement, regard earnestly all the life that surrounds you. Because the truth is everywhere, hidden deeply. The Upanishadic seer spoke about the truth of truths. Not truth as we think it is. What we think is truth may be just fact, but deep within that is the truth of truths. Regard earnestly all the life that surrounds you. Learn to look intelligently into the hearts of men. Let us not believe that I know. That's why Krishnamurti repeatedly said, you don't know your wife or your husband, your parent or your offspring. You think you know, because you may have never felt that, you never realized that there is that divine spark within, that thing which is full of meaning, of beauty, of goodness. And Light on the Path continues to say, if you do not look intelligently, learn to look intelligently into the hearts of men. To look intelligently means from an absolutely impersonal point of view. Otherwise, your sight is colored. Don't say, so-and-so is my wife, so everything is right about her or wrong about her. In the Upanishads, there is a very famous dialogue part of which it is said, the wife is dear, not because she is the wife, but because the divine spirit, the Atma, is in her. The husband is not dear because he is the husband, but because of the Atma within. So, can one put aside all these personal elements, the previous likes and dislikes? Let us not say, I know this person, so it's difficult, or a rascal, or somebody is wonderful, more wonderful than anybody else. These may all be the petty little ideas in our heads, the colorings which have come from previous experiences which we collect in the brain. Intelligence is impartial. If there is this personal element of liking and disliking, what I want and what I don't want, attachment or repulsion, then the eye is not clear, the perception is not penetrating, and we cannot come into contact with truth. So, inquiry means unloading the mind of the continual aggregations. You know the well-known sentence about keeping the mirror of the mind free from dust, the dust of one's personal views and likes and dislikes. One must unload the mind constantly, let go, look, regard earnestly, not in order to comment and criticize past judgments, comparisons, evaluations, but just to look respectfully, to learn more about life with humility, because the learner is not one who knows, he does not know, and he must be free of conceits. And when his mind is thus, at least comparatively free, empty, open, sensitive, watching life, then he will begin to understand more and more of the truths which have been stated by those who have already done all this and who have spoken from their personal experience, awareness. And then one is all the time learning. Learning is a process of coming to something new. If we repeat what is said in this or that book, or repeat our own previous thoughts, it's all stale. But if we are learning, looking, regarding life earnestly, regarding our own heart most earnestly, then all the time it is new insights come. So the process of understanding theosophy directly becomes something very very interesting. I don't find the right word. Gripping. Because it's all, whatever we find is something new. Something we have found directly for ourselves. And perhaps what we discover will be the same as what many people have said, but it will be a new theosophy, new aspect of theosophy. There is an ancient saying that it is the one truth that the sages speak of in many different ways. Every person who experiences the truth, that means the significance, the meaning and purpose of anything or everything, speaks in his own language. It comes spontaneously. In fact, I don't quite agree about all this discussion over language. I know that it has its own value, but anyone who speaks from actual truth doesn't have to bother about language, because the language will take its own shape, just as the sap which is in a plant, the life which is somewhere, takes its own form because it is full of vitality, energy. When there is the vitality of truth, then the language comes of itself. It will be appropriate to the situation, suitable to the times, and to the person to whom the words are spoken.
Thank you very much for the talk. Is there any questions anyone would like to ask?
I raise a question because we have invited an inquiry, but I am doing this, you know, shaking in my shoes. Now, I've more or less kept a thread of your talk, and it seems as though that I've also read recently an article by Professor Lloyd Gearing, Peace Studies in New Zealand, of the intolerance of the traditional premise, and also by Archbishop of the Russian Orthodox Church, in an article on St. John's Revelation, apostasy, the decadence of mankind started with the Great Schism, in that man, by removing the premise, the traditional premise, or the spiritual premise that he works from, that everyone has elemental power or spiritual element in their psyche or in their system, their functional system that you have been talking about, and that is connected with the spiritual power above. Now, that has been attacked with the schism, with reasoning coming in. Reasoning has taken over human rights, and you're talking about reasoning having got to balance this with that. But what's that other tradition has been wiped out of the platform? Man is just tumbling into decadence, bringing up all these sort of bits and pieces, arguments, secular humanism. I would like to ask you, therefore, whether you mentioned sparks divine spark in them, that you had not elaborated on that too much, and whether that is central in perhaps returning man closer to that premise platform, and that perhaps making things easier for man. I don't know, perhaps I'm a bit confused in my question. Thank you.
The question is a little confusing, if not confused. I was not talking about setting aside anything or argument, or I hope I didn't give the impression that I was speaking about that. I was speaking about inquiry. There may be spiritual premises which are of profound value. But if we are believers and simply say, yes, I accept it, then we may be no nearer to truth. On the other hand, we may be putting ourselves in opposition to somebody else who says, I believe in something else, which is different. This is the whole problem of humanity, that of taking positions. Inquiry does not mean rejection, setting aside, or anything like that. Nor does it mean blind belief, acceptance. Inquiry means, as I said, respectfully going into the question. Let us say there is a scriptural statement of value, or a very intelligent, wise person makes a statement, or a scientist says something, the greatest respect we can pay to him is to ask, what does he really mean? What are the implications of all this? If what he says is true, how should it be lived? If we don't go into all that, simply say, yes, I believe or I reject, then it doesn't help. So I think the spiritual journey consists in giving, in taking the statement, if it is of value, seriously.